This recording is produced by Reverend John L. McKenzie, president of the Catholic Biblical Association, who is currently professor of biblical history at Loyola University, Chicago. The subject of Father McKenzie's talk is Theologies of the Old Testament. This recording is copyrighted by the Catholic Biblical Association. All rights of reproduction are reserved. No copies may be made without permission.
Literary criticism, as an aid to the interpretation of the Bible, has been in use only since the late 18th century. Criticism was not applied to the Bible until its principles and methods had been established in an elementary fashion in the study of other literatures, and over 100 years of heated debate followed before literary criticism was generally accepted in biblical studies. It has not been universally accepted even now, but no scholar questions its legitimacy. Biblical literary criticism is almost entirely a science of deduction from evidence which is formally contained neither in the text nor elsewhere. The evidence is amassed from indications which are not obvious, and the conclusions often appear to be hypothetical in the highest degree. Time does not permit a full exposition of the principles and methods of literary criticism. But if the work of literary critics is well done, it recommends itself by the consistent picture of the book and its composition which emerges. Now, one of the factors which help the critic to see whether he is correct in assigning dates and authors to books is the theological outlook of particular books and passages. If we can, without obvious strain, propose certain patterns and schemes of theological outlook in various books of the Bible, and if these schemes suit other patterns which can be erected on principles of style and vocabulary, we can propose very probable opinions on when and how the parts of the Bible were written and what its authors thought they were doing. Let us mention a few of these dominant theologies of the Old Testament and consider some of their characteristics and contrasting themes. The first of these theologies which I choose to discuss we shall call the theology of the Jahwist. One may interject, I have searched my Bible from one end to the other, and I find no book which is called the Jahwist. This is quite true. Critics, however, have convinced themselves that the Bible contains a very substantial portion of a document which once existed and which they have long called the Jahwist for lack of a better name. It would not be difficult now to give it a better name when we consider how much we think we know about it. One good name, if perhaps too long for convenience, would be the history of early Israel as told in the kingdom of Judah. This title implies a number of presuppositions which I cannot justify here. I wish to talk only about the theological outlook of the document. Let us postulate some generally accepted critical conclusions. The document was a history of early Israel. It was probably written in the early years of the Israelite monarchy in the reign of David or of Solomon. It began as early as possible with the creation of the world. It is found in the books of Genesis, Exodus, and Numbers. It very probably carried the history of Israel up to the reign of David, but the latter part of the document has been so dismembered by compilers that it can no longer be clearly discerned. The passages which are assigned to this author or to this school of authors exhibit certain consistent theological views. To this document is attributed one of the most substantial contributions not only to biblical thought, but to the whole history of human thought. The Jahwist was the first writer known to conceive history as a unified process with beginning, middle, and end. This conception is altogether original. Nothing like it occurs elsewhere in the literature of the ancient Near East. And Greek historians did not form this idea of history until much later. History as the single course of the adventure of man first appears in Israelite narrative. The principle which unifies history is the action of God in Israel. We shall call him Yahweh because that is what the Israelites called him. His action makes history one because history is determined to a purpose established by Yahweh, the God of Israel, and its movements are directed by his operations, which at times become direct interventions. The Yahwist writing in the reign of David, the date which many scholars prefer, began with the origin of mankind. The scope of his history is as wide as all humanity. The breadth of this scope comes from his conception of Yahweh as the one God who governs all men. The purpose of the Yahwist is to show how the will and providence of Yahweh, beginning with mankind in general, comes to a focus in Israel. History is the account of how Israel became the people of Yahweh. How did Israel become his people? The Yahwist takes us through the stories of the ancestors of Israel. In these, we have a theme which is peculiar to this document, the election of the younger brother. This may not seem important, but the idea of election has a very long history. All the passages in which the younger brother is chosen seem to come from this one document. For instance, Isaac is the younger son of Abraham, but he is the heir. Jacob is the younger son of Isaac, but he is the heir. In the story of Joseph and his brothers, as told by this author, Judah has the primacy among the brothers. In another Israelite history, of which I shall speak next, it is not Judah, but another brother who is preeminent. This theme of election seems to reflect the attitude of this author towards the dealings of Yahweh with Israel. David was not the first king of Israel, nor was he the son of the first king. He had no claim which might rest upon inheritance. The Yahwist points out that in the election of David, the pattern traced from the beginning is continued. So Israel became the people of Yahweh. It is not the oldest people of the world, nor the most powerful, but it is chosen. History is governed by the operations and the direct interventions of Yahweh. Critical events such as the migration of Abraham, the entrance of the sons of Israel into Egypt, and their departure from Egypt are marked by an intervention of Yahweh. The greatest of all interventions is the departure of the sons of Israel from Egypt and their deliverance. It is this event which made them a people where before they had been merely a clan or a tribe. Israel's awareness of its identity as a people, we believe, first appears in the Yahwist, and it is worth a moment of reflection. After all, most social groups have no history. The number of peoples who have written their history is a very small minority of the entire population, past and present, of the globe. Why is this? Because history, the idea of what it is and the idea of writing it, arises only in people who have reached national self-consciousness, the awareness of their position and their importance in the course of human events. This awareness stimulates the desire to affirm their identity in some permanent record. So they will not depend on the somewhat slippery oral tradition in which most men have preserved their past. This self-consciousness and the historical activity which comes from it can be seen in other peoples besides Israel. We observe that when a people reaches a certain point of national development, it becomes aware of its identity and of the identity of its present with its past. History is a people's affirmation of its own distinct identity. It is distinguished from other peoples by what it is and by what it has been. Through its history, a nation tells the rest of the world and its own members what it believes it is. This is the work of the Yahwist. Israel is distinguished from other peoples because it is the people of Yahweh. The story of Israel is the story of the action of Yahweh in the history of Israel, in particular of that great saving act by which he created a people. From this theme, we can see other theological elements. One is the conception of Yahweh. The stories of the Yahwist are almost all characterized by a high degree of intimacy between Yahweh and man. This intimacy is strengthened by the figure of speech we call anthropomorphism, the representation of God as endowed with human features and human emotions. The degree to which God is so endowed with human characteristics is higher in the Yahwist than in other Israelite histories. This very human representation of Yahweh makes his relationship more intimate with man. He speaks to man and is spoken to by man. He is a God who makes himself known as one man makes himself known to another. The human traits which are given to him are sometimes extremely naive. Yahweh comes down from heaven, for instance, to see what man is doing. Having come down, he reviews it, deliberates upon it, and then makes up his mind. Yahweh has eyes, ears, hands, feet. He walks, he speaks, he hears. All this brings him closer. The theological conception, reduced to more abstract terms, is a conception of a God who is very close to man, who has an interest in man and a will for man's destiny, and is active in the course by which that destiny is achieved. The story of the Yahwist is generally rather optimistic. He lives in a world which is not the best of all possible worlds, but a world in which things seem to be moving as they ought. On the hypothesis that he wrote during the reign of David or Solomon, this optimism is easily understood, because under the monarchy of David and Solomon, Israel achieved the most favorable political, social, cultural, and economic situation it had ever known. It was a nation prosperous, victorious, and secure from external threat and internal strife. It had a stable and effective government. In times like this, literature is very likely to be optimistic. To the Yahwist, the best had been achieved when the monarchy of David was established, because to him life in a monarchical society was the best form of life in society for man. It afforded better opportunities for man to realize his potential than the life of the nomadic tribe or the life of the more despotic governments of other areas of the ancient world. And best of all, it moved towards a society in which Yahweh ultimately was king. And so the destiny of Israel, as presented in this work, was tied up with the kingdom of David. The further destiny of Israel consisted in the expansion of the kingdom of David to become the kingdom of God. This conception of the destiny of Israel has many echoes in other books of the Bible. It lies at the root of the idea of the messianic king and the messianic kingdom, which appears in the prophetic writings of Isaiah and in many of the Psalms. The reign of God is the term towards which humanity tends. Israel first, and then the rest of mankind, must be incorporated in the reign of God. The idea begins in the Jahwist as scarcely more than the national self-consciousness of which I have spoken. The theology of the king and the kingdom, which is called by some modern scholars the Royal Jerusalem Theology, is the development of the work of this historian. It has its limitations, as I must point out. It does indeed attach the destiny of Israel as a nation too closely to the faith of the nation. It lacks some of the breadth which other theologies exhibit, but the idea is supremely important in biblical theology. The optimism of the Jahwist is not total. It is, after all, this writer who gives us the story of Eve and of the primeval sin of man. He also gives us most of the stories of early man, such as the story of Cain and Abel, and of Lamech and his vengeance. He has an account of a deluge, the catastrophe by which the sin of man is punished, and the story of the Tower of Babel, a story of pride. He tells of the murmurings of the Israelites in the desert on their passage from Egypt to Canaan. The thread of sin runs through his story. Yahweh acts against sin by establishing the kingdom. Through this means, Yahweh overcomes the evils of mankind, which the historian has surveyed in the earlier part of history. These are but a few of the themes which can be pointed out in this single document. To make good my title, Theologies, we must turn now to another theology and another document or set of documents. We call this theology, rather clumsily, the theology of Northern Israel. Modern critics call the document the Elohist, not a very good name, to distinguish it Jahwist. Let us recall that the monarchy of all Israel endured only under David and Solomon. After Solomon, there were two kingdoms. Modern historians feel fairly sure that the two components which we find in the Old Testament, Israel and Judah, were never really one. Many scholars believe that the group which is called Judah was not united with Israel before David, that the name Israel always excluded Judah, and that the union of the two under David and Solomon was somewhat artificial. But since it endured for two or three generations, this was long enough for the traditions of Israel and Judah to be merged. Thus, Judah and the Yahwist have the story of the Exodus, although Judah very probably had no part in the experience of the Exodus. This was an adventure of Israel. Israel, more properly, seems to be centered not around Jerusalem, but in the central region of Palestine, around the city of Shechem in the tribe of Ephraim. In the Elohist traditions of northern Israel, the primacy among the sons of Israel is held not by Judah, but by Joseph and the son of Joseph, Ephraim. The Elohist traditions, which are not as well preserved as the Jahwist traditions, apparently did not go back to creation. In the Elohist, the monarchy is not a theological idea. It is purely and simply a political idea, and in the Elohist conception of Yahweh and Israel, there seems to have been no room for a king like David. Why not? There are several reasons, and here we see the difference in theologies. The ideal Israel, as we find it in the Elohist tradition, consisted in a confederacy of 12 tribes. This confederacy is religious rather than political. The Elohist theology shows little interest in the political activity of Israel. Israel maintains its integrity by the union of the 12 tribes around the shrine where Yahweh is worshipped. This shrine is not the temple which Solomon built. It is a tent in which there ought to be an ark, but David had put the ark in Jerusalem as a symbol of Israelite unity. We can point out the reasons for this difference in view. The area of northern Israel was more exposed to the influence of foreign peoples than was the territory of Judah.